Neil Ruddock, defender and notorious hard man. Please don't hurt us, Neil. Played for Spurs, Southampton, Liverpool, West Ham, Millwall, Swindon and QPR. One cap for England, now television personality, appearing on I'm a Celeb, Harry's Heroes and something called James May's Man Lab. Plus, author, in fact, double author. He's got two books and today we're reading one of them, 1999's Hellraiser. So let's see what the book club and our special guest, Kevin Day, think of it on today's Football Book Club.
I just wonder if any books written that year were allowed to have, because he seems to have used up the entire year's supply of exclamation marks.
Alan Sugar, Neil Ruddock is the original Taylor Swift, Kanye West.
Do you, Ham Street Village Hall, take Bambi to be your lawfully wedded husband?
All he did was take off all his clothes and cover his penis with a Budweiser. That's all he did.
All he did.
Hello and welcome to Football Book Club, the only book club where, instead of literary classics, each episode we read another footballer's autobiography. Less Robert Frost, more Bas Dost. And
as soon as he said Robert Frost, I was like, "Where's this going to go?"
Yeah.
And then I was Bas Dost.
We don't usually have continental ones, so it's quite exciting for us to get someone in. And that was David Smith. You sent us that one, so thanks a lot, David. I'm James Buck. Over the weeks, we'll be reading classics such as David O'Leary's My Story and Tim Cahill's Tiny Timmy Soccer Superstar, which really rolls off the tongue nicely. But today, we're reading Neil Ruddock's 1999 book, Hellraiser, and joining me to read it are Jack Bernhardt.
Hello.
And welcome to the show, comedian, writer, and co-presenter of the brilliant Price of Football podcast, it's Kevin Day.
Hello.
Kevin.
Point out your fact file was very accurate, but you missed out one club that he played for, which of course was Crystal Palace.
Oh, I was gonna say,
when he was legendarily fined four times for being over 16 stone and he's still one of the least popular players that Palace have ever had.
Wow.
He was sent off, and I think his third game, and he walked off waving at the Palace fans, blowing kisses. It's like, and somebody had to point out to him that we were the home fans that he was taunting. There was a half-hearted apology the next day.
But yet, you despite saying that about Neil, you're chummy with him, Kevin. You told me.
Well, this is one of the reasons I really wanted to read this book when you kindly invited me onto the pod.
Our pleasure.
Because I know Neil. I met Neil a long time for a family that he grew up with in Ashford. One of my closest friends, Mark Webster, was a very close friend of him. And his brother. So I knew Neil through him. And then I've worked on a lot of TV sports comedy shows, and Neil was always the go-to guy. If you wanted somebody to take his clothes off the 500 quid, it was always Neil Ruddock that you approached. And he was perfectly happy to do so. His agent had a scale of how many clothes he would take off for how much money. And essentially what he would do, if you offered him another 500 quid, he would display everything. And then I ended up doing a podcast with Neil.
Oh,
And I really like him. I really genuinely like him. He's an interesting bloke. But the reason I wanted to read the book was that Neil he talks very well about football. He's well informed about politics and currency, but he's painted himself into this corner with his image of this hellraiser, heavy drinker, no nonsense, straightforward, games gone type attitude to football that no one will come near him when it comes to talking seriously about sport. So I wanted to read this book, partly because obviously I'll read any football book from the 70s, 80s and 90s, but partly because I wanted to see what he was like then and whether it was, and quite clearly within the first chapter, you can see him heading towards that corner with his can of paint.
Yeah.
Even back then, he was painting himself into the corner. Yeah. He was setting up his image in this book.
He knows his brand.
He does, but his brand is now so tragically out of date that the book is from an era of fantasy football and they think it's all over and the sort of whole 90s lad thing, and that book very much reflects that. And of course, luckily, I was part of that culture myself, and I'm delighted that it no longer exists. But Neil hasn't quite moved on, and it's a shame because, as I say, I've had some of the most interesting analysis of defending and from Neil Ruddock. And yet, if if he was approached by a serious broadcaster to say those things, he would just go, no, game's gone, too many foreigners. Right. He would panic.
Or he'd be like, where's my 500 quid for the shirt? Yeah, it's 500. Yeah,
I'll take the shirt off for 500 quid. Yeah. So
Rio Ferdinand sitting next to him just go, no, please, yeah. Please, no.
So that's one of the reasons I was so interested to read the book. And it's very interesting. I just wonder if any books written that year were allowed to have, because he seems to have used up the entire year's supply of exclamation marks in that book as well. And it's very, even by the second part of the book, he's running out of exclamation marks. I don't think there's any colons. It's all exclamation marks.
There are a lot.
And then she made me a cup of tea. Exclamation mark. Yeah.
Who'd have thought it?
Who'd have thought it? Literally. Yeah. And then I punched her in the face. No exclamation mark for some reason. Because presumably that's more expected.
Very serious moment. Yeah.
But I did enjoy it. But it's like, I'm sure you haven't asked me a question yet, have you?
I'm
sorry.
This is great.
It's my wife does, normally my wife sends me out into the office with the words, please, I know you like the sound of your own voice, but can you try and answer the question that you're asked rather than launch into.
Is she like your manager before going on a podcast?
A little bit. Yeah,
sort of the towel. Give me a team talk outside.
Just rubbing the shoulders down, give me a bucket to spit in. And say. But it's like so many books, and as I say, I'm sure you've mentioned this, the book could be 100 pages shorter, but most incidents are mentioned three times from different angles. It's like he even very early on in the book, he says, yeah, my brothers didn't want me to make the same mistakes they did. And my dad didn't want me to make the same mistakes my brothers did. And later on, my mum didn't want me to make the same mistakes my brothers did. My brothers knew that my mum and dad didn't want me to make the same mistakes. And my brothers were like, yeah, we've ascertained that your brothers were quite decent footballers and you didn't want to make the mistake. It's like, and I've never known a book as well. The first chapter, he talks about he literally sets up the rest of the chapter.
Is what I want to say.
It has the structure of a university essay.
Yes,
it absolutely does.
You don't need to read the rest of the book because it's every highlight from the club, every highlight of every story.
I'm not proud to say I was required to leave university before I actually finished my first essay, so I'm not entirely sure whether you're correct in that. But it could have finished after the first chapter. You kind of. Yep. He just, because I didn't expect to hear those stories again. I thought, well, he's just getting out some of the lesser stories.
Yep.
And yet they all come back in greater detail. And it's a really interesting structure. But again, as I'm sure you've discussed, how much of it is Neil's words and how much of it is the, whether he sat down, did he sit down for 10 days with the guy who wrote it? Literally half an hour. But
The age old debate with that. I mean, Jack actually interestingly wrote his dissertation on Neil Ruddock. So that's why he knew it was quite a lot like a university essay.
I nearly fell for that. You'd be amazed.
Imagine the restraint I would be showing if I was like, I know so much about Neil Ruddock and I've read this book so many times.
You'd be amazed for a hard-bitten middle-aged left-wing comedian. You'd be amazed how naive I am, how easily I fall for. I am that bloke in the pub who goes, really? If somebody comes, it's like an old chap came up to me before a Palace game recently and said that he played for Palace in the 30s and 40s in Division 3 South. And I was 10 minutes into this conversation before he went, no, of course I didn't.
I'm younger than you.
Now we'll make sure we don't take advantage of you during the conversation, I promise, Kevin. That's what you think of the book. But should we get some Amazon reviews to see what other people think of it? Just, before we check in with Jack as well on that. The book has 4 stars out of 5 on Amazon from 33 reviews, including this 5-star one from anonymous Amazon customer hiding behind an alias. Love him or loathe him, there can be no denying that Neil Razor Ruddock has not been one of the most interesting footballers of the last 10 years. And I looked into that. That's a mistake. He didn't mean to write not. But he started off in a bad way.
There can be no denying that there certainly isn't, to be fair. Yeah. There must be a way to...
His always gives 101%. And as we know, sometimes this gets him in a little bit of bother. In his book, you can clearly see where he gets his short temper from. But you will also learn about his love for his family, his sense of humour, and overall his love for a game of football. This book is worth every penny. And full disclosure, I think this book cost me, if you're wondering, Kevin, I think it cost me 356 pennies. £3.56, I think, was the price of the book.
Do you know what? I was interested to see, it was published in 1999.
Yep.
And it cost £16.99 then.
No way, did it?
It's on the inside.
Oddly, £16.99. I love books, and, I have too many, so I periodically have to clear some out, but I have to get if I'm out with my family, they will edge me past bookshops because I will inevitably right. come out with another book about Anne Boleyn that I don't need.
Or Neil Ruddock's got another book out.
Or
Neil second Ruddock. One. Okay, yeah.
£16.99 was quite a lot of money, and it's that review is interesting because I've been told to always be suspicious of anonymous reviewers, of course, but he doesn't talk about his. He mentions his brothers very early on, but then. His marriage comes out of the blue. She barely gets mentioned. She gets mentioned twice again, I think. He doesn't mention having children. He gets married. He says, "Oh, that's quite a good year because we came fifth in the old Division One, got to the semi. Oh, and I got married."
No sense
of where. At one stage later on, he mentions that she's from the East End.
Yeah,
it's the only time he mentions the East End without adding jelly deals and pies in, which he does every other time he mentions the East End.
Yeah.
And then the next time he mentions it, it's because he's had a perfectly pleasant conversation with Ian Wright, and he comes home and tells his wife this.
Yeah,
I've had a nice chat with Wrighty, and she says, "Not Ian Wright." And I go, "Yeah," and that's it, and that's the wife dealt with.
And she says, "You haven't spoken to me for 15 years. Who are you?"
We only know he has kids. Because there's a photograph in the book of him with kids. There are some of the most random. He's not in two-thirds of the photographs.
I tell you, there's a photo which is of Bruce Grobbelaar not even on the pitch, just going to court, which is
in a hat.
Yeah, in a hat.
And he doesn't say what the court case is.
But he doesn't talk about that. No, it's not in the book once. Yeah.
There's a terrible photograph of Glenn Hoddle who's barely in shot, which just says, "Here's Glenn Hoddle, who I mentioned."
It would kind of make sense if these photos were taken by Neil Ruddock and it was like his, like, you know, scrapbook.
Absolutely, but also the other thing about his family, he mentions at the age of 16 he has a difficult career choice to make because my dad had gone to work in Saudi Arabia you think, hang on, this is 1986. Can we at least have some context as to why your dad was going to Saudi Arabia? Because that sounds like it might be interesting. And again, when he talks about getting thrown out of Southampton... on one page, he talks about Chris Nicholl, the manager, telling me this.
Yep.
The next page, it's Branfoot, the manager. Yeah. Not even the full name of Branfoot, and no explanation as to why Chris Nicholl was no longer the manager and Branfoot is. And he makes Branfoot sound like a Jane Austen character, like an elderly retainer. And it's like Branfoot came in and said my services were no longer required. Yeah. And it's like, hang on, you just
Branfoot the butler.
Exactly. It's like, I know who Branfoot is because I'm old enough to remember he was the manager. But you haven't told it's kind of it because you have to keep reminding yourself when you read it that this was 1999. It was a throwaway topical Christmas book, I assume. But his lack of detail on some things is incredible, and it's too much detail on other things is amazing. Like, I'm going to read the list of nicknames of the players from his pub team, which is one of the bits I insist on reading out.
Kevin, please, now is the time. Now is the time to read this.
I adore this section so much.
Do you know what? The reason I love a nickname. I know a friend, his nickname's Lord Nelson, because he couldn't get into the Navy when he was 18.
Right, okay.
So he's been Lord Nelson ever since. So the poor man's reminded that his career ambition was another thing.
Okay.
There's a chap called Fireplace Jack who sells fireplaces. Why not?
Nice.
One of my closest friends is called Gaz because he doesn't look like Gary Shaw. He used to play for Aston Villa. But this list of nicknames, it completely trumps them.
Yep.
We all used to play for the same pub team, the Fox. And we certainly had some characters in the side, all nutters, but all great lads and decent footballers too. Every single one had a nickname, which they're still known by today, and I can't let the opportunity pass without a full roll call.
Yeah.
Which, in other words, the publisher said, we're a couple of pages short.
Yeah, exactly.
If you could. So here's the full roll call.
Yeah.
Here's the full roll call of players, people in his pub. Jacko, brackets, that was me. Then there's Phantom, Albert Hall, Dobber, Double Dobber, Dobber's big brother, Bambi, Padge, Poker, Strutter, Legger, Remington, Roger Miller, Mad Muttley, Mental Mio, Doris Day, Ham Street Village Hall, how that one came about, I don't know, Spanner, Spud, Kid, Claude, Zubizarreta, Social, Lofty, Fagin, Striker, Woody, Willow, Homer, Oaksy, Bosco, Clark Kent. These are Crofts names as well. These are just their kennel names. You'll find.
And by the way, you're only about halfway through.
Yeah, halfway through this.
I'm going to finish. Snellers, Hodge, Spartacus, Ivan Lendl, Sherbar, Judgment Day, Tonto, Bullfrog, Wanker Williams, Shed, Dickie, Rossi, Bushy, Conehead, Conehead Matthew, Big Brother, Butch, Scotty Brooks, Yogi, Charlie the Limp, Tomo, Bert, Bullseye, Satellite's German Boyfriend.
That's incredible. What
which, is that one?
Nicknames are supposed to be shorter than the actual name. Satellite, on my head, Satellite's German Boyfriend, Chalky White, Tradesman's, Deno, Chili, Signal Box, The Real Padgy, Fierce Lodger, Chief, Bunger, Silky, Meat and Two Veg, Turkey Tell. And then there was Colin Wilson, not forgetting, ha ha ha, do excuse me, I didn't realise you played for Ashford Town, Storm the Bastille, and apologies to those that I've missed. And you think, A, how big is this bloody pub?
I agree. Many,
and also, B, what worries me that these people are now in their 60s, yeah. And they're... I just really hope they're not known by the same same nickname, because they're all nutters. Here comes Padge. Here comes a German boyfriend.
There's Ham Street Village Hall. You, Ham Street Village Hall, take Bambi to be your lawfully wedded husband.
It's just bewildering away, isn't it? And then the fact that he's apologised. The fact that I just feel sorry for someone called, you know, Nutter Nige is getting the book and going, I'm not in it. He hasn't
going through them like Tradesman, Deno, Chili, Signal Box, The Real Padgy. Where's Nutter Nige?
Not there. It reminds me, and one of the reasons it makes me laugh as well is a friend of mine you spend a lot of time on a Palace message board. Like every club, we've got loads of different message boards, and they decided that they would have a meeting that they could put names to faces, and they booked a pub in London Bridge. Which he went along to, and he said there's about 70 or 80 of us. But the problem is, of course, that they all had to have their username and a little badge so they could recognise each other. And he said, the problem is that my friend's username was Penge Penis. So he was getting off the tube, putting this badge saying Penge Penis, and then he said, and he turned up, and Shagger turned out to be this 87-year-old bloke. Hyman Buster was about 14. Eric Bloodaxe was a girl, and it's just there's all these bizarre people. With these bizarre nicknames, and I wonder if Neil, how many would then would Neil recognise? I think they have the little name tag on.
I think Penge Penis played centre back for the Fox. I'm pretty sure he was there. In
Penge Penis to Doris Day, back to Mental Mio.
Jack, what did you think of the book? Do you enjoy it?
I actually really did enjoy it. Okay. I mean, I think Kevin's right. He loves a tangent.
Yeah,
there are so many good tangents in this book. Mm. There's a bit where he's talking about how there was a how his old headmaster or teacher like used to help him out, and he said, interestingly enough, he became our milkman. Not relevant. why'd you tell me that?
His old headmaster's in there because his old headmaster said he would never amount to anything while he still had a hole in his arse.
Oh yes.
It was his sportsmaster that became his. And
poetic justice.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy it. I agree with Jack. I did find it entertaining, but I just found it. You keep going, and because like a lot of it's like, and then this happened, and then a lot of it is self justification as well. A lot of it is like that one wasn't my fault.
There is a lot of that.
And there's one thing. I was going to say, Jack. One thing I found on that note. One thing I found frustrating was there's a bit when he goes off. He talks about I went off the rails at Liverpool. And then he never specifies what the things that happened during that period. I was like, this could have been a great, but you never quite go
into
it.
There's a lot of bits where he's like, the scandal. There's scandal, or like, I was going through some personal troubles here. And you're like, well, you don't go into them.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a bit, it's hard to work out, as you say, like, there is a lot of self-justification and questions as to what happened in his career.
That's really interesting. That's one of the notes I made, because he says, and I think the chapter title is something about the scandal. I mean, the chapter titles are terrible. Alan Sugar turned it sour. Is not, but that's a really interesting point, because he does make a promise. He does say that's when it all went pear shaped. I had an almost Gaza like meltdown, which is again really interesting. Mm. That generation of footballers adore Gaza when the reality is that he did some nasty things as well as the funny things, but they all adore Gaza. And you think, well, if he's comparing his meltdown to Gaza, this is going to be really interesting. And it's like, I knew that he had dark moments, but then. The worst thing he describes is sitting on his own in a pub, having a couple of pints because he's been dropped from a game. And it's what's really interesting, he comes back to several themes, but they're all themes, again, which indicates that he hasn't moved on. It's like foreigners don't mix. There's a worst crime. We'll talk about the incident with Patrick Vieira as well, I think, because that's the worst thing that could ever happen that a footballer could do. because footballers are still obsessed now. I guarantee you watching the Atletico Man City game.
Oh, yeah.
It's like Rio Ferdinand. You know, they're talking about the headbutts and the tackles. They didn't get anywhere near as angry as they did when it's. And then he pulled his hair. He pulled Jack Grealish's hair.
Oh, like, yeah, that's true.
That's the sort of thing that infuriates them. And he mentions several times players that don't mix. Stan Collymore, he dismisses because he wouldn't come to the pub. Nigel Clough was handy because he could answer crossword questions, but he wouldn't come to the pub, so he wasn't unhappy when he left. He talks about Paul Merson's so-called drink problems.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
I think those bits have aged quite badly, but I think he probably wouldn't write it in quite the same way nowadays.
Sure he wouldn't, but he constantly refers to the fact that we're elite athletes. We can run these things off.
Yeah.
We metabolise things differently to you. But the whole thing, the not mixing thing, it's incredible. And he talks about the John Hartson and Ayle Berkovic incident where... Yeah. He admits, almost grudgingly, that John Hartson probably shouldn't have kicked him in the head, but then actually says, I'm not convinced he was kicking him in the head. I think he was aiming for the shoulder and it deflected. But then he dismisses that. excuse me. Then there's a whole page of him having to go at Ayle Berkovic for not being happy at being kicked in the head. He accuses him of being a grass at one stage.
This is the second book in a row we've read that's happened. Weirdly, Frank Lampard talked about the same thing when he was at West Ham. And because I think Berkovic had a go at Redknapp, didn't he, in the press, I think, or something.
Yes.
Didn't like West Ham in general.
Yeah,
he said they're a pub team. But again, Ruddock says it's typical of the sort of foreign mentality that they have to run away to their own country before they're brave enough to say these things. How can you know? That's simply not Britain. But he talks about team spirit so many times. It's the greatest crime for him. It's like, and even now, Ian Wright will talk about when Wenger first came in.
Yeah.
And it's still furious that they weren't allowed ketchup.
Yep, that's...
It's like this madman...
Yeah. I don't think we'll ever get over that as a country.
Almost every single one of these books of an English player will be like, do you hear they banned ketchup at Arsenal?
Even when Conte came in, they were doing the same thing. I remember when Ramos came in at Spurs, they did the same thing. It was like, oh, Tom Huddleston can't have ketchup anymore. And it was always Huddleston they picked on, sadly.
There's a quote, I've marked it, but I've lost my super paper, where I can't remember which particular foreign player it is. It might be Margas... Who goes away?
Oh yeah, the Chilean.
And then comes back and and then is suddenly so into English culture that he has a bulldog tattooed on his arm. But he moans about foreign players putting gravy on the jelly deals and mash. It's like they come over here, they don't respect our cultural background. They put gravy on the jelly deals and mash. It's because jelly deals and mash are disgusting. It's astonishing. You can almost hear, that's the time when you think that he was definitely involved in writing this book, because he still has that element of astonishment that people wouldn't want to drink several pints before a game.
Yeah.
Can I read you one particular quote, which I like? It talks about when he's at Southampton, a team inspired by the brilliance of Matt Le Tissier. But then he says, must have been something to do with his pre-match meal, which used to consist of a double whopper with large fries from Burger King, all washed down with a couple of pints of Coke. In fact, I can remember on the day of our biggest game of the season at home to Liverpool, there was me, Letiz, Barry Horn and Mickey Adams all filling our faces at the local McDonald's just a couple of hours before kickoff. Most players' pre-match meal consisted of chicken, fish and pasta. That's you foreigners, by the way.
Yep.
But ours was a burger and fries! And then this is the bit where you understand the footballer's humour. We were all in hysterics when Barry piped up with, do you think John Barnes and Ian Rush will be tucking into McDonald's? That's the silence that you would expect from that rhetorical question rather than Roddick saying, oh, we're just in hysterics when he said, do you think Ian Rush is having a burger?
Yeah.
And then and he doesn't mention what the result of the game was, so I'm assuming that a pasta-filled Ian Rush may have scored many more goals than a burger-filled Matt Le Tissier. But again, it's that absolute, complete and utter bemusement way football is going.
Yeah. I think Letiz, that's been a long-term thing, perhaps, all those Big Macs. I think if anyone looks at the kind of things he's saying on Twitter these days, I think Big Macs are fine for a little bit, but maybe they play with your head after about 20 years or so. Perhaps.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. Clearly, some of them weren't quite as cooked as well as they should have been. But again, you imagine... Because I can't stress enough that Neil is an intelligent man.
Yeah.
I imagine Neil would be quite happy to talk about bizarre conspiracy theories and to take them down unless he was asked to do so seriously, in which he would go, what do you think of the conspiracy theories? Well, never mind that. he used to have two Big Macs before a game, because that's what he's locked himself. That's what he's locked himself into. Unfortunately,
it's interesting because I feel like reading this book, you can see there's elements of that. I was surprised by quite a lot of how he was trying to get away from his like his hard man reputation a lot of the time. Like it felt like in a few bits of this book, he didn't like go into it as much as he thought he would.
Well, and he always seems like he's trying to get away from it a little bit. He says that a lot. How he's warned over and over again. He goes, and I try and restrain it, try and keep it back a little bit and then push it back, because I thought it'd probably be more of these kind the banter between the lads and stuff.
To be fair, we've read a lot of these books
fairly tame compared to some of them.
Well, that's interesting to know, because I think he was probably between a rock and a hard place at the time, because he was still playing, which was interesting, because normally you would expect this book to be written when he'd finished playing, when he wasn't worried. So clearly the publishers probably wanted the full gory details. But his agent would have been saying, look, you're still playing. You can't be saying that you went out to hurt somebody that you hated somebody and you're
not Roy Keane.
But at the same time, that's what people are buying the book for.
Yeah.
See, that's at the same time, they get a lot of what they expect. But as you say, I was expecting far more detail of feuds that he had with players,
fights that he had.
And there's an interesting bit, because right at the very start, when he talks about being involved in the infamous night at Luton when the Mill fans went on the rampage, which was the night when the Thatcher government finally fully turned against English football fans, and English football at the time was horrible, it was despicable, and I'm as nostalgic as any football fan is, but there are certain elements of it that I really, really don't miss, and that's one of them. But he he talks about the exhilaration that Millwall fans had of having that reputation, and he talks about them being provoked into behaving like that, and he talks about them afterwards not being at all sorry, and you kind of think, well, he's not sorry either. He's sorry that his manager saw him on TV on the pitch with the other fans. So at that stage I thought, actually, this is going to be proper gloves off.
Yeah.
But the gloves go firmly back on.
And
even when he talks about the Peter Reid thing, when Peter Reid was so upset by an elbow in the face.
Peter Reid pops up in this book.
Peter Reid watch.
Peter Beardsley, I beg your pardon.
Oh, we almost had an unintentional Peter Reid watch.
Not Peter Reid watch.
I'm sorry to have excited you so much. No, when Peter Beardsley, an incident I recall, when Peter Beardsley tried to sue him for loss of earnings because he elbowed him in the face, not only does Neil dismiss that allegation, he claims that it made him a better looking person. So there's a couple of things like that that are in the book, because you think that's what his readers want, that's what his what he wants. But clearly he's been told to rein himself in, and I in the end you kind of think, well, I would leave all that out together and just say, look, I'm not going to talk about this because I'm much better than that. I'm a really good footballer. I had terrible injuries at times in my career. These are the managers I like. This is why I like them. These are the tactics I like. This is why. There's a couple of hints at why Terry Venables is a good coach. And you think, we'll follow up on that then. I'd like the whole chapter to be, why is Terry Venables a good coach? Why
not just because he's one of the lads, but more the tactical side of things.
Absolutely. So Harry Redknapp was one of the... So why does Harry Redknapp's style work? But why does Brandfoot's not? Yeah. That's the sort of thing, as a football fan.
Yeah, I definitely.
He does fall between two stools, and it's like...
unsatisfying.
I think it's amazing that he didn't... Because it wasn't that long before the end of his career, and it's like, just wait, why not wait a while?
This is midway through the 99-2000 season. He's just like, I'll do a book.
And also, he clearly has got a little black book with a long list of names in it. And again, the Vieira one, which I'll read to you if you want, it's incredible. It's an incident where Patrick Vieira is now the manager of my football club, Crystal Palace, doing a very good job.
Yep.
One of the most iconic players of the time that this book was out, and it's quite early in Vieira's... And after a bust-up, Vieira spits at him, which is disgusting. But footballers, there are two things that footballers hate more than anything else. That's when another player won't shake your hand afterwards, because whatever's gone on, you have to, and it's always man up. You man up, you shake somebody's hand, that's the end of it. They hate that, and they hate spitting. And he talks about Vieira spitting at him, and he says, and I quote, "It's the most disgusting and degrading thing a footballer can do. And then this is in a book wherein Neil Ruddock has told us, amongst other things, that he's broken Andy Cole's legs, both of them, headbutted two people, punched Robbie Fowler on an aeroplane because Robbie Fowler mistakenly thought he pissed in his shoes. Right, when we're talking about disgusting and degrading things, is sued by Peter Beardsley and nearly severed Alan Shearer's toes in what he called a hotel prank that went a bit wrong. And so of that list, being spat at is worse than all those things in that list. And that, but that really sums up the mentality of footballers. And Razor will tell you that now, because we this pod we did was like the A to Z of football.
Yeah,
we got up to G, I think, before Razor decided he wasn't being paid enough by this production company and got and got bored, basically. But it was really interesting because we talked about different aspects.
I get double this for taking off my shirt.
Yeah. But, no, it's sensitive, yeah. But again, it's still those are still the things that upset him. Players not shaking hands, players flicking each other or spitting, and it's there's this masculinity in him that for him hasn't helped him. This masculinity has helped him as a footballer, but clearly in the rest of his life, sadly, it hasn't paid off for him. We that documentary that ITV did when Harry Redknapp, it's always Harry Redknapp, putting together a team to beat the German team from 1990.
Oh, Harry's Heroes, yeah.
Harry's Heroes. And there was a moment there's a big argument when Ruddock's drunk in a cafe and Paul Merson is trying to help him and trying to stop him drinking, and it kicks off. And you can see how visibly upset Paul Merson is.
Definitely.
And Paul Merson is a man who's grown up and matured and confronted the problems he had with gambling and alcohol. And I think is the more interesting person because of it, whereas Neil has refused to do that. Whereas Merce now is honest enough to say, these are the things that happened to me. I wasn't in control of them. I was in a toxic environment. Whereas Neil still yearns for that environment. He still longs for it. He still aches for the those days that have gone and probably never were even at the time when you proved yourself with your fists and your elbows, but then you justified it by saying, I only did what I had to do. But, and that's why, as you say, he falls between two stools in this book because he clearly can't decide whether to be the full hard man or, and tantalisingly, occasionally gives you a glimpse of an intelligent man and then panics and reels backwards into another story about somebody getting slapped after a prank went wrong. It's like, which is the other thing that clearly English footballers at the time hated more than foreigners and being spat on, was a prank that went wrong. It's like, if you didn't prepare your prank properly, then you should be ashamed of yourself. And it's like, because that's the thing.
Do a funny prank, like taking off all your clothes and driving about on a car. That's what they have, isn't it?
When we talked about John Moncur being the funniest, even funnier than Gazza, and the two illustrations of him being even funnier than Gazza are letting a fire extinguisher off on a fire eater in Covent Garden, which A is a bloke trying to make some money and on his phone, and secondly, once walked onto the training ground naked, apart from his boots,
in a public training session.
And there was another Don when he talks about Don Hutchinson, the shameful reaction when Don Hutchinson, they were in a pub one night and there were some young girls celebrating some exam results, and they were filming it because they were excited. And Don Hutchinson, all he did was take off all his clothes and cover his penis with a Budweiser. That's all he did.
All he did.
And for some reason, the press picked up on this, and he got into trouble. And
blown out of proportion.
But again, he says it's all to do with these girls. They probably got some money out of it.
That's so true.
The Ivan Berkovich thing. It wouldn't have happened except for some weasel who'd been invited onto the training ground. He'd won the competition, this weasel, and he filmed it on his camcorder because otherwise it would have been dealt with in the proper manly way. They'd have had a tear up. The manager would have said, "Get it out of your system."
Yeah.
No one would have said, but just because this bloke filmed it, John Hartson gets into trouble for kicking a man in the head. He didn't even mean to kick him in the face.
He kicked him in the shoulder and his wrapped
his willy in a Budweiser wrapper.
But that's the brilliant thing off the back of the John Hartson. He said he didn't mean to kick him in the head. He was aiming for a shoulder and missed, but that's how his season was going. He was missing chance after chance. It's like, here's your opportunity, Neil, to say, look, sometimes players let their temper get the better of them. Sometimes in training things happen, and these inexcusable things happen. But instead, it's like, he couldn't hit the target at all that season.
That sentence
sums up the whole book, I think. I think you hit the nail on the head with that one, yeah.
Yeah, and he even says, I know Iwerfitch is a little fella, but you'd think he would be able to And it's but then of course he prefaces it by, and he's absolutely right. John Hartson is a very, very nice chap. Very nice chap. Also, again, he's an example of someone who, when you talk to him, has moved on from those toxic masculine values, who seems to have read other things and discussed things with people, and now is a very thoughtful pundit and a very thoughtful commentator on football issues and mental health and his own battles with his own physical head injuries and brain operations. And yet Neil is one of those people that is still stuck. He's still, you can imagine Richard Keys and Andy Gray in Doha lamenting like Neil the way the game has gone and how terrible it is. And you can listen to it every day on the podcast. It's a shame because Neil Razor is so much more than that. And there are bits that I really like when he talks about how he got his nickname Razor, but he also implies that he clearly isn't that fond of it, because he says that my oldest friends still call me Jacko. That shows a different side. That shows him that he's happier in the company of something. But they're only tantalising glimpses of the Neil Ruddock that I know, and I've seen it. You'll do a podcast with him. He did this thing. He was talking about the first time he played in a European game, and he did the usual. Oh, they're really hard to play against because they dive a lot and they're little, and they only eat pasta before a game, so they're cheeky and all this stuff. Yeah, they've got skills, but they're always like trying to niggle you and kick your ankles. They're not brave enough to kick you in face to face, man to man. But then
Hartson to Berkovic.
But then he gave this brilliant as I asked him his question about whether it mattered if a left-footed central defender should be on the left side, and he did this whole brilliant explanation of why a left-footed defender should play on that side, but it's all to do with the physics of the foot that you take off on. And then he talked about playing against continental players because they turn, they get closer to you and they turn much more sharply than they used to in the Premier League. And it was a really interesting 5-minute analysis, but then he suddenly caught himself on. You could see him go, "Oh, hang on, this is not Razor Ruddock. This is Jacko talking here. The audience don't want Jacko. They want Razor." So then he went into, and then of course you can't kick him because the referee's booking for anything over there. And then you don't want the food in the dressing room, and it's all, and you just get disappointed. But then of course all the comments on this pod we did, we're all about, good old Razor, game's gone, it needs more people like him.
Yeah.
And Mark and I are doing the pod with him. We're going, no, I genuinely don't think, I don't think we do. And it's like, and it's that's why I find the book so genuinely frustrating, because as I say, you just get glimpses then that he knew already that he was locked into this persona.
Yeah, it's. I think, first of all, I'm very impressed by the amount of thought you've given this book. First of all, because we get people on who give it a lot of thought, but they'll go like, "Oh, it was very funny when the guy kicked someone," or whatever. Like, they'll pick up on one topic.
Hey, how dare you insult my analysis?
Yeah, usually Jack. But to go to that, I think we had Guillaume Balague come on a few months ago, and he wrote this book about, you know, getting into Maradona's psyche and everything. I think you need to write this book for Neil Ruddock. I think you need to do the similar thing to tell the true story of Neil Ruddock and the things that he's not writing about and why that's important.
Every time Razor gets mentioned, I do kind of want people to know that he is a much more interesting, complex character than he lets on. And I sometimes worry that he doesn't want people to know that, because I think he would have just got so much more work, for example, if he'd been as publicly articulate as he can be in private. But he doesn't seem to want to do that. He's locked in, as I say, he's locked into this image. But
this is finally your chance. Who would have thought you would have come on a podcast to read a 1999 book by Neil Ruddock, and this is your chance to finally spread the word about Neil Ruddock?
Do you know what? I'm worried that I've overanalyzed it now, and I should have just come up with a couple of quips.
Yeah, well, that's the end of the book.
So I'm worried that you're losing listeners as every minute goes by when I'm being serious about this book. You go, hang on a second.
We could do with losing a few of them, to be honest. Like, so we get some of the messages.
Don't stop listening.
We're going to go on a quick break, but before I do that, has anyone got an out of context Razor for us this week?
His opening gambit when he walked into the dressing room to meet the lads for the first time was to point an accusing finger at me and Wrighty and say,
hey, you two, you take it to piss or what?
Yes. The actual, like, actual writing of Italian out there is fantastic.
Yeah, that is you take a deep piss.
Yeah. Kevin, as our guest.
I gave you my context raise with the hamburger reference. I jumped the gun. But I'm sure if I were to briefly flick through, but there's a bit where, out of the blue, he says he was injured and he went off to Tenerife. And the chairman of Liverpool were there. Lo and behold, the chairman of Liverpool was there. And I said, hello, Mr. Moores. And he said, we're on holiday now. Razor, you don't have to call me Mr. Moores. You can call me David or Moisey. Moorsey. David or Moorsey. And Roddick's response to that is, oh, what a gentleman. What a gentleman. Can you imagine Alan Sugar saying, call me Alan or Sugie?
Sugie.
Sugie
is a very
funny. And it's like the fact that you can call me Moorsey, which is like... And you think back to all those nicknames in the first bit of the book.
Yep. Yeah.
Moorsey, surely Roddick's reaction would have been, that's the worst nickname
that wouldn't have made
ever
a first draft. Wouldn't have made in a first draft.
I don't want to call you Satellite's German boyfriend.
Yeah, I'm going to call you Mental Moorsey. That's where you are from now on. You're Mad Moorsey, that's what you are.
Yeah.
You just had a second pint at 12 o'clock in the eyes. Anyway, so then Mad Moorsey comes up to me and says, I was sacked from Liverpool. Yeah.
I think The Apprentice would be a lot better if it was, hello, I'm Shuggy, well, and you're fired.
Well, talk about The Apprentice. We are going to come back to that later. So let's go on a quick break. And afterwards, we will meet Alan Sugar and we'll be chatting about more footballers' pranks.
Hi, we're Football Book Club Podcast. And we need your support now. Let's drop the appeal music. Hi everyone, James here, and I just want to tell you about the brand new Football Book Club Club, which you can join to receive bonus weekly episodes, access to exclusive member events, and your very own Football Book Club book bookmark, all for the same price as a used copy of Darren Huckabee's 2007 book, Hucks. So if you enjoy the podcast and need to hear more afterwards, head to patreon.com/footballbookclub. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, I'm Kevin Day, and twice a week, Liverpool University accountancy boffin and the self-confessed most boring man in Britain, Kieran Maguire, and I discuss the money behind the beautiful game on the Price of Football podcast.
We cover all levels of the game and clubs and leagues all over the world, so you can know the difference between your amortisation and depreciation and your FFP and your EPPP, whichever team you follow.
I'm just counting the P's. Yes, it's not just about accountancy, though, thank God. You'll also regularly hear about sordid nights out in Russia and Blackpool and get to enjoy frequent contributions from Kieran's dog, Finlay, as well as our Broflake bromance.
Every Thursday, we look at the latest football finance stories, and every Monday, we answer your questions about anything related to the money side of the game. All you have to do is email us at questions@priceoffootball.com.
Just search for The Price of Football in your podcast app and give us a follow now to get every new episode as soon as it comes out.
Welcome back to Football Book Club, where we are still reading Neil Ruddock's Hellraiser with Kevin Day. Hello again, Kevin.
Boom.
Hello.
I want to bring up my topic for this week, which is, of course, as a Spurs fan, I was pretty interested reading those bits. I didn't realize he played for Spurs twice. Actually, I'm a little bit younger. I didn't know he went and then came back.
To be honest, James, I'm a little bit older, and I'd forgotten that he'd played.
Did you? Yeah.
Forgotten that he played twice or didn't play the first time.
He played a couple of few games at the end of one season apparently, and then he went off to Millwall from there. But
which again wasn't his fault, like so many things. Yeah. Wasn't my fault, Gunner.
Yeah. It happens very quickly. That was very. I'm sorry. Yeah. But the most interesting thing I found from that segment, and so Kevin, usually on the podcast, we have our friend Tash is on the show, and she'll often try and draw some pop culture comparisons. And I realised going into this that this is incredibly Tash of me to do this. But I think the highlight of the book is finding out that the Alan Sugar Neil Ruddock is the original Taylor Swift Kanye West feud, because and I can justify this. It's all about when Alan Sugar sacked Terry Venables. Neil Ruddock wasn't happy about it. He has some kind of like one man protest about
the
fact.
Held a placard up.
They have a photo of that, and it looks incredibly embarrassing.
It does. And actually, there's one other he does mention his wife there as well, because apparently she went around his house in Chigwell with like a placard and did that. But then Sugar's not happy. Neil Ruddock puts in a transfer request. Then he's on holiday, and apparently Alan Sugar phones him, and they kind of make up. They kiss and make up, and he thinks he's going to sign a new contract when he gets back. Then he flies home to sign this new contract, Alan says he's agreed nothing and reveals he's been taping all of his conversations with Neil Ruddock all along. And that
is really weird.
It is super weird.
Do you know what's really weird about it as well is because it's a really interesting story because he loves Venables so much that he's outraged that Venables is sacked because Venables and Sugar hate each other. Because he talks about how Tottenham are on the verge of becoming a really good team and coming out of Arsenal's shadow. And again, that's quite interesting because it's worth remembering that Tottenham then weren't the wannabe superpower they are now. He talks about that. And then he does his thing. And as you say, he reveals that Alan Sugar says, "I've been taping our conversations." And the story fizzles out completely. Yeah. And you think immediately, well, that's because Alan Sugar's version is clearly backed up by the tapes.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly the same thing. Yeah.
Version of events is erroneous.
Yeah. So it's like, because famously Watergate didn't end in a similar way.
Well, that's one part of the book you think, I'm not sure I would have included that, really, because it really does fizzle out. Because you're reading it and you kind of think, I must have known it at the time because I was grown up when it was happening, but it had sort of passed me by. And I was thinking, this is really quite interesting. The start of the modern era of football, and here's this player with a shonky cardboard, the sort that you see in a crowd now with a seven-year-old has done, asking for
a shirt.
Declan Rice's shirt, basically. And then the end of the story is, turns out he had this tape, and that was it. I was off.
I was sold. I was fine.
But then again, it ends with, but I was sold to Liverpool, so fuck you, Sugar. I win.
Yes. And in fairness, it didn't work out.
But again, it's that thing with him. It's like he has to win everything. And when he doesn't, he just moves on.
Yeah,
it's like because when he can't report a triumphant outcome to this thing, he just off he goes.
On this note, after this, I think there is the most possibly, and no offense, Neil, but I think it's the most made up story I've heard in a book. And there's quite a lot of stories that are on the verge of being made up, but there's one just after that where Sugar's still getting annoyed at him, and he's at a game, and he scores an own goal, I think, for Liverpool against Spurs.
Oh, God.
And he heard somewhere that Alan Sugar was saying, I knew he still wants to play for Spurs. And then he goes, actually, joke's on you, Alan, because he tried to sign me back no fewer than five times that season. And then he goes, I think he tried to deny it, but my story was absolutely true. And as I go through this, I think you'll start to realise it probably isn't true. I was even told on one occasion that Ozzy Ardiles, the Spurs boss, had been around to my house on his way back home from a game at Man City to see me and ask if I fancied to move back to White Hart Lane. I wasn't at home at the time, and Ozzy called at the wrong house in any case. He went to a neighbour's house, and they relayed the story to Liverpool chairman David Moores, who then just had he related to. But it definitely happened. It definitely happened.
I know about it because of this.
But that's one of those bits in the book where you think, because I genuinely laughed at that, and I thought, I wonder if I'm meant to laugh at that, because it's again it's Razor having desperately to win so much that the reason is he didn't go back to Tottenham was that Ozzy Ardiles was so desperate to get him that he hadn't checked his address.
Even
before the computer days, it was fairly easy to phone the secretary of the club, I would guess, and say, "Have you got his address?"
Yeah.
And then knocked on a random and then gave up. And they thought, "Oh well, this is
like I will never find him. He actually lives next door. No, it's fine.
Impossible.
It's a very short cul-de-sac with four houses. He's not in this one. Fate, the stars obviously are not aligning. But the other thing as well, because he loves Venables so much, and again, my relationship with Terry Venables as a Palace fan is an odd one because he was a legend and then he was part of the reason why we got into big financial trouble. So, but he's in the same way that Neil Warnock is worshipped by seven of the players at every club he managed and despised by the other 15. Venables has inspired loyalty beyond Harry Redknapp to an extent does the same thing, but Venables, there were so many players of that generation who really rate him. And again, it would have been really interesting to find out why more of that in the book. But he relates as an illustration of how quick thinking and how funny Venables is. He tells a story of Venables going up to a manager and saying, "Now, just remind me of the rules. If I called you a wanker, would I be in trouble?" And the referee says, "Yes, you would." And he says, "Well, if I thought you were a wanker, would I be in trouble?" And the referee went, "No." Then he said, "I think you're a wanker."
Good joke.
And he said, "The thing is, I've heard that. I've heard that story about Brian Clough.
I've
heard about every manager and every player. And it's like the other." He tells three stories about how dim Liverpool players are. The famous one that
Jason McAteer,
which I thought was Jason McAteer, he says it was Donnick Matto, who said, "Do you want your pizza sliced up to 8 or 16?
That's a classic one. Yeah.
No, 8. I couldn't manage 16. But the other ones are kind of like he and Roy Evans was such an idiot. He once said, "We're going to have 2 5-a-side games with 7 players in each team." It's like. So clearly what he meant to say was we're going to have 2 7-a-side games. And so that's not necessarily something you need to clutter up the book with, to be perfectly honest.
But then, think of all the nicknames you could have put in there.
That's true.
Well, I think Roy's nickname, it transpires, he mentions in passing, is something like Ernie, which again, he doesn't explain why he's called his name. But it's, you just wonder at the time whether the guy who and you can hear, what is interesting about this is I have read books that are ghost written, and you can't hear the voice of the person.
Yes,
whose book it is. But with this, it's clearly Razor's voice. You can sense that he's clearly spent some time with the guy. Presumably, you'd guess in a pub in Essex somewhere, but he's clearly spent some time with the guy. But you do wonder whether the guy who writes the book occasionally says to him, "No, Neil, I've put that story in 5 other people's books." That's in Peter Beardsley's story. It's about a tip from apparently Kevin Keegan said that to a manager, to a referee as well. So it's like, but maybe he was too scared of Neil to not put
possibly,
it in.
Possibly, possibly. If only been recording it like Alan Sugar likes to do. That helps massively. Also, shout out to end my section. The book front cover. I describe what it is. It's him in kind of like a neon blue and white, putting his fingers up his nose with a baseball cap on. Does it remind anyone else of those? You wouldn't steal a DVD. Kind of adverts.
Yes, definitely the colour.
That's
yeah,
like that kind of screenshot. I'm going to share a picture for that, and then the back is just.
You wouldn't break both of Andy Cole's legs in a reserve game
in the same tackle.
Yeah. Jack, I know there was a character in the book that you particularly enjoyed, who's popped up in a few of our books before.
It's the Southampton goalkeeper John Burridge. Oh my God!
Whoa.
We've had a few run-ins. Yeah, a few run-ins with Budgie. He turns up in Andy Gray's book. He turns up in Matt Letizia's book. But he, in this, oh my God. I feel like I fell in love with him properly for the first time here. He's mad.
He was Palace's goalkeeper.
Everyone's goalkeeper.
In the late 70s. In fact, the big match opening titles used to have him as part of the montage.
That's interesting.
Because what he used to, bear in mind, this was the days before mobile phones, when on-pitch entertainment was normally the Palace Crystals, which were a group of scantily clad, barely legal girls in tight shorts doing it. And what John Burridge used to do was a series of elaborate gymnastic moves as part of his warm-up. He would do proper... And at one game, he climbed onto the crossbar and started doing pole work, like Nadia Comaneci on the crossbar, while we lost our shit. This was going on.
I'm sure,
but he was a brilliant goalkeeper. But that's one of the things in the book that I found really, really interesting, because I didn't know. I knew the story about him going. So I've done several things at the club with him when he's come back as a legend type thing. So I knew the stories about him going to bed in his goalkeeping kit, and he always said that. He never dreamed of anything but football. He couldn't remember dreaming about anything else but football. God, so he told a story about his wife, like in true Peter Sellers, Pink Panther style, not now, would pop up out of the fridge and throw oranges at him to catch.
So practising his reflexes. That's so funny.
So I knew that story, but I didn't know that he did a non-stop match commentary throughout the game, because Razor talks about it's one of the funniest things I've ever read, let alone in any football book, where he says... So Burridge would roll the ball out to John, and Burridge would say, Burridge rolls the ball out casually to Ruddock. Ruddock looks up, hits a short left-footed pass to whoever, and just all the way through. And apparently that was his way of concentrating. But you'd like to think if you were playing with him, I wasn't very good at Sunday football, but that must be the most distracting. At some stage you're going to say to the keeper, "Will you shut that?" But that image that he describes of John Burridge doing that is just... hilarious. And you kind of think, because he implies that there is lots more things he isn't telling us, and I suspect a lot of them are more are more like that, and I'd be so much more interested in reading that sort of stuff.
I need to get Budgie's book. I think that's next time.
I genuinely think we need to get Budgie's book.
But Jack, what was it that really interested you about him in that?
Well, first of all, I will say that when I play football, I also do commentate.
You have played with me before.
It's incredibly annoying.
I can vouch for it.
He's got the ball. He takes it over here. Oh, he's got round one. He's got round another.
Kevin, Jack also used to do fake Soccer Saturday commentary when he was a child, apparently. It used to go around the ground.
Why would you tell other people this?
I think
why?
You've told the podcast before. I think it's important for people to know.
So it's actually very predictable that I would do that. Yeah. But the best story with Burridge in this book, surely, is the one where he decides to he decides to practice push-ups.
Oh my god!
he gets himself a bar and says he just comes into the training room one day and says, like, here we go, I've got a bar. He hangs it up. He starts nailing it into the wall with some nails, this metal bar, and then he goes, okay, now time to do some pull-ups. Everyone's watching, and he grabs onto it and starts screaming, and everyone's like, oh. Classic Burridge, classic Inspector Clouseau Burridge. He's like, no, it's a real problem. He had nailed this bar into an electrical cable.
Yeah.
And the bar was now properly electrified. And as soon as he jumped onto the bar, he electrocuted himself.
Yeah.
And because it's one of those, you imagine it as a proper cartoon with you can see the skeleton face and the hair.
Yeah,
you're going up and, like, Home Alone.
And the fact that everyone around is like, "Ooh, look at Burridge having a great time."
It's a brilliant story, but again, as James says, it's one of those stories you think that can't be. But it's a brilliant story.
I don't know. What's interesting
with this budget, my son
Ed Knight, who's a comedian and Palace fan as well, every now and again, if we both come home late together and bored, we'll go quick Lauren Hardy, and we'll watch a Lauren Hardy just to relax and unwind. And we watched the one recent Helpmates where Stan does the same thing, except he accidentally puts a nail through a water pipe. And you think, okay, in a Lauren Hardy film, I'll take that. But I'm not sure that even in the 90s, when things were a bit more laissez-faire, health
just
and safety,
for a Southampton Villa match. Yeah.
John Burridge actually came in. And I think the walls would be more, I think they'd probably mark where the cables are. It's still a brilliant, funny. It's a really
how
funny
dare
image.
You try and take that image away from me?
Also, John Burridge, I would guess, was 15 stone. So okay, I'm not sure entirely that he thought through. If it did happen, he hadn't thought it through. The fact that because he's not going to be got up tall enough anyway. It's not going to take his weight, and the fact that they just stood there watching him.
I think I was really expecting that was where the joke was going to go. I was like, oh, he's going to grab onto him and fall down and he'll injure himself. Also, the fact that he was being electrocuted.
It's also brilliant. It's at the end of the book, you think, I can understand you standing around in hysterics while Gazza throws some popcorn onto a once clean floor. But that the same reaction shouldn't be happening when a man is electrocuting himself before your eyes, because he said that's what they all do. They stand around pissing themselves laughing at the fact that a man could be literally losing his life in a comedy fashion.
Imagine in the film Jurassic Park if Sam Neill just did that when the kid's trying to climb over the gate to get in, the T-Rex just sitting there pissing himself and Timmy just getting fried. That'd be great. I had I'm gonna end our chat on another guy who was a prankster in the book, Steve Sedgley, who does one of the strangest pranks I've ever heard. Shout out for creativity, I guess. Sedge, in particular, was great for morale because he was one crazy guy who'd do anything for a laugh or be the centre of attention. The club prankster. I can remember being woken up in the middle of the night whilst in a hotel prior to an away game by Steve, who seemed to be crying out for help. I went to the door of my room at about 2 a.m. and he was stood there without a stitch on, screaming in agony. They have to be naked. Screaming in agony with something sticking out of each nostril. On closer inspection, it turned out that he'd got two wine gums hanging from his nose. So I took him inside because he was causing such a scene and tried to remove the offending sweets. As we freed one, he put it in his mouth and ate it, then did the same with the other before saying, thanks a lot, returned to his room without a word of explanation. I need to find out that he had a 2 a.m. wake-up call just to do this. Strange boy, said.
But it's also what I love about that story, because then he tells another story, which he says was the prank that he thinks drove Paul Merson to drink. Psychologically, you think, which part of that helps team morale? Well, he says this is the sort of thing that really bonded a team together, the sort of thing a team needed was a naked
destroying
man
people's lives.
Destroying people, putting wine guts up his nose. And it's the fact that he's that Neil clearly admires the fact that he got a wake up call to do it.
Yeah,
that this is.
I'm
impressed with that. I really think if I got the wake up call at 2 a.m. and they were like, "It's your 2 a.m. wake up call because you were going to stick some wine guns up your nose and bother Neil Ruddock," I'd be like, "Do you know what? I won't do that now."
But again, it's one of those things where it implies, yeah, you wouldn't find a foreign player with a commitment to do that. Yeah. Yes. Although there is one bit.
I think he might be right.
There is one bit that did make me laugh as well, because I just. It's the sort of thing I've said myself occasionally on a world-weary basis. When Nico Klaassen comes back from the World Cup.
Yeah, Spurs.
He's played quite well for Spurs, for Belgium.
Yeah.
Had a decent World Cup. And he finds himself playing in a pre-season friendly at Tooting and Mitcham. And just says, as Neil says in his broken English, "What's happened to my career?" Which is it's the sort of thing I occasionally find myself performing at a comedy club that I did 20 years ago, thinking it's not quite gone as... well, as I thought, that was just
for the listeners' benefit. That's the first thing Kevin said when he came on the call today. He said, what am I doing here? Well, what's happened to my career?
Oh, it was the World Cup a minute ago.
I should have started by saying they say you do this pod twice in your career, once on the way up, once on the way back. It's good to be here again.
Wait a second, that's a Kevin Keegan line.
Well, that brings us to the end of the book. The book ends at West Ham, like halfway through a season, like Jack mentioned. I think they're about to win the Inter. They're about to qualify for the Intertoto Cup.
They won the Intertoto.
They got that, and they're into Europe proper.
Yes, that's it.
But you made a classic mistake there, because you mentioned West Ham without putting in brackets afterwards. Happy family club. Jelly deals,
ties. True. Apologies.
Which he does every time he mentions West Ham, it adds a bracket after it about what a happy.
You're absolutely right. Apologies, I missed the caveat. And then he goes to Palace, which isn't in the book. Then Swindon, then he retires, which isn't in there. Might be in the next book. Who knows? But the big question is, did this book change you? And I want your rating out of 10. Jack?
No.
Okay, yep.
And no, and a 6, I'll say. 6. It was fun in places.
Okay. I'm going to give it a 7. It didn't change me. I think chatting to Kevin has made me change my opinion on a lot of things.
That's true. I've enjoyed Kevin's insight more.
I wish everyone could read a book with Kevin. I think you'd be a very good member of an actual book club, Kevin. I think this is the...
I did enjoy the book. It's a 7 from me, because I have read a few footballers' books, and it is more entertaining. There is more insight. I mean, that doesn't say a lot for the other books, which literally are. And then this happened.
Name
and then that happened.
Any in particular you can remember that you've read?
No,
no, don't give me any ideas.
Because they're so unmemorable, they don't stay with you. But there's a better book in there, struggling to get out, but. Given the time it was written and the context of where his career was at that stage, I think it is actually quite a good book. I don't know whether it was serialised in a tabloid at the time.
Yeah,
Or whether it had any effect, razor reveals or something. But it's actually better than I was expecting it to be. But again, I would like to know more about his school days, even though he dismisses the whole. First 15 years of his life, basically he's waiting to be old enough to get served in the pub, and he talks a little about his brothers being better footballers than him, but he kind of think, well, tell us what happened then, why did they not, because he just dismisses that with then they discovered girls and pubs. It's like, well, come on, there must be something about you that made you better than them then. There must be, tell us why you were more disciplined than them. Tell us what it is. Did you make sacrifices? But there's none of that. And I suspect it might be because he just said, no one's interested in that. But they are. And really, I kind of think it's a shame that it's not in the book. But still, I did still enjoy it. 7 out of 10, yeah.
Well, it got 6.6 recurring out of 10, which is a very hard number to give it that. In total, on average. Maybe he talks more about it, and you can look forward to reading The World According to Razor, My Closest Shaves, which came out in 2020. Next time you're on the podcast, Kevin.
Absolutely.
We'll eventually do the Ruddock trilogy when the next one comes out as well. Quiz this week. I'll tell you what, usually on the quiz, Kevin, what we do is I give everyone a funny nickname from the book, but we've been spoilt with nicknames in this book. So I want you guys to choose your own nickname. So you can choose anyone from that page 25, his teammates from the pub side, the Fox. That's who you are. And when you've chosen your name, when I ask you the question, if you think you know the answer, shout out your new nickname. Does that make sense?
Can we change every time?
No, you've got to stick with one. Who are you going for, Jack? On the list.
I will go for Judgment Day. That's intimidating.
Judgment Day. Okay, cool. Kevin, you got one?
Well, you'd think I'd go for Doris Day, wouldn't you? As that was one of my nicknames at school, I'm going to avoid that.
But yep.
I'm going to call myself Charlie the Limp, because I like to think that Charlie the Limp was a slightly older gentleman who probably best days were behind him, but could still dominate. You know, the first 6 yards are in your head.
Yep,
I like to think that he stayed in the centre circle and could still pick a pass, but just the legs were gone. So that sums me up.
Oh, you've created an entire character. Yeah. I think my guy was just a lawyer.
Yeah, or probably he couldn't get an erection, I imagine, is probably the true story. Basically, is how nicknames seem to work in Razor's world, essentially.
It sounds like a 30s criminal, Charlie the Limp.
Charlie
the Limp. Listen to me, Charlie the Limp. You're going to get Judgment Day pretty soon.
Question number one. What is Neil's philosophy? And shout out your name if you think you know what it is. Shout out your new nickname if you think you know the answer.
Charlie the Limp. Are we implying this from what he talks about in the book?
He says my philosophy, it's six words. He says it at one point, this is my philosophy.
Oh, crikey, no. Because I was going to say essentially Nietzschean, but it's
that is above what it is. I'll give you the answer. It's make the most of it, son. So, which I don't think Nietzsche ever said. But
he's fulfilled his. That's a self-fulfilling philosophy, isn't it? He has done that. Yeah.
He did make the most
of it.
The
Nietzschean quote on my head, son.
Question number two. Where did Neil get his nickname Razor from? I think you know this.
Ah, yes, Charlie.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a Canadian boxer called Donovan Razor Ruddock.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Donovan, yeah, Razor. It's a Canadian boxer whose nickname is Razor.
That is close enough. He fought at White Hart Lane, I think he did.
Yes.
And that, which was interesting.
There's quite a few stories in the book of them being at sporting events and not being the ones who trashed it.
Yeah, Grand National is one.
At Cheltenham. Okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't us. Well, don't put the story in then. In that case.
actually, bonus point if you can name his other nickname before. Because I think you said it was Jacko, but I've got another one.
Right. Judgment Day.
Yep.
Wait, it is Jacko. We're talking about Jacko.
There's another
one
he had, I'm sure.
Oh, was he?
I think so. Pretty sure. I've got it in front of me.
Oh. I don't know.
Think about it. It's a footballer's name.
Kevin? No, Keegan?
No, he's obsessed with Kevin Keegan, isn't he? But I don't know.
Schuster. After Schuster.
Free kick
prowess.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Question number four. So far it's 1 point to Charlie the Limp. What song did Neil, Jamie Redknapp and Steve McManaman sing at a bar on the day he signed?
Oh my God, Judgment Day. And it's so funny. It's not. Oh my God. I overthink it was so funny and I can't remember what it is now. Is it? It's not My Way. It's not You're the One That I Want.
It's definitely not You're the One That I Want.
I can't remember.
Strangers in the Night is the answer.
That's it.
I should point out, I worked with Jamie Redknapp on A League of Their Own. And on studio days, recording days, I'm with Jamie all day. So my job is. You know the way some thoroughbred racehorses like to have a little fat pony in the field with them to keep them calm? I'm Jamie's little fat pony.
Okay,
lovely. I make the eye contact for him. I love Jamie to be. I generally do love Jamie to be. I've never met a man less curious about the world, but he adores Razor. He absolutely adores Razor. He John Barnes, he worships John Barnes. John Barnes is his biggest hero, his role model. But he loves. They were roommates, and he genuinely gets excited when Neil comes on the show. He did point out the first time Neil came on the show when he did end up naked. That he just went, I can't tell you how many times I've seen that in my life.
We've all got a friend like that, yeah.
Yeah, he really, really loves Razor, and he's nice. Again, he says he gets frustrated because he says he's not like he says he is, you know, and he really. Helped to guide him through his time at Liverpool. So
that's I'm going to give you a bonus point for that.
What?
I
should make up some stuff about Jamie Redknapp next time.
Question number five. Name any of the foods a Liverpool dietitian recommends Neil to eat when he hits 15 stone.
Oh, Charlie the Limp.
Yep.
Sugar puffs.
Sugar puffs, bizarrely, is one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, he doesn't explain why.
It's got sugar in the name.
That would be the case. Why would that help you lose weight?
Yeah.
More sugar puffs.
Did the honey monster work at Liverpool?
You should eat. Yellow dietitian came in one day.
You should eat sugar puffs.
Okay.
Yeah. If he did, there would have been a story about Razor taking him out in training.
Yeah, probably. But yeah. I wasn't there.
Yeah.
Anything else? Anyone else can name any of the two things?
I can't think of. Was it pasta? No.
Pasta is one. Pasta? There you go. Yeah, you get point.
Okay.
I didn't say your name, but yeah, that is correct. The other one is beans on toast.
Yes.
I'll be honest, you're not going to get the last. You're not going to be able to catch up, I don't think, for once. What's your name? Fine. Judgment Day. However, final question. Who did Neil win his only England cap against?
Charlie Limp.
Oh, Judgment Day.
Charlie Limp was in
Nigeria.
First.
Nigeria.
No, he smashed it. You have smashed it.
Oh, I've been destroyed.
The Limp. And as your prize this week, Kevin, you win this week's Ken Zong. So Ken is our friend who comes on. I always enjoy doing this with guests who don't know who he is. Our friend Ken, every week he writes a chant for a footballer who's since retired. He fits it to another song. And actually, he's got us a Palace themed one this week.
Oh,
just for you. Just for you, Kevin. Which I don't think I've done before. I've lost track of the ones we've done, and I've done this, I'm sorry, but just treat it as Ken Zong's greatest hits, guys, if I've done this before. To the tune of Aerosmith's Dude Looks Like a Lady, here we go, cruising up just looking to score, all you've got to do is beat our back four, but he's long locked you in his sights, and it won't be too long, you know he's winning that fight all night, da-da. Da-da, Damien Delaney. Da-da, da-da, Damien Delaney. There we go. Ken's on.
That works really well.
Had I done that one before, Jack?
I know. I feel like I have a memory of you awkwardly going, da-da,
da-da. I do too.
So,
but if I did it before, sorry. I'm glad you enjoyed it though, Kevin. Fond memories of Damien Delaney?
Damien Delaney would very much enjoy it as well. Damien Delaney, again, one of those memorable surprises, he sidled up to me once at a Palace thing and said, I saw your name on the credits of Have I Got News For You? I said, right. He said, is there any chance you can get me tickets for a recording?
Oh, wow, that's cool.
And I said, yeah, of course I could. He said, I love that show. And then he came to the show and he was locked in conversation with Ian Hislop for, he had no idea who he was, but for several hours afterwards, good. Talking about all sorts of, and then he took, exception when Richard Osman criticised one of our players and Damien Delaney told him in no uncertain terms that he was wrong and knew nothing about football.
So,
Damien
Delaney is one of those players who, when he first joined us, he think it's his duty to learn as much about the club as he possibly could, which I think Damien Delaney would approve of this book. My guess is that Damien would be nodding at that going, yeah, I would have done that. That's exactly what I would have done.
Sure.
That's exactly that. No, but that's a great chant. I'll make sure that gets passed on to him.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
Pass our regards to Damien. That's all for this week's episode, but we'll be back in a fortnight. If you can't wait 2 weeks, make sure you join the Football Book Club Club on Patreon, where you receive 20 minutes more Football Book Club action every other Monday, plus your own Football Book Club bookmark. Head to patreon.com/footballbookclub. In the meantime, make sure you get in touch with us on Twitter at Footy Book Club, Instagram at Football Book Club, or on Facebook. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on. Tell us about The Price of Football.
The Price of Football is an unexpectedly popular podcast about the finances of football, which both Kieran Maguire and I, when we first agreed to do it, both said, well, probably 4 weeks, that we'll have done just about everything there is to do. But it turned out that there is an amazing appetite out there for football finance. So I'm the kind of emotions idiot, and Kieran knows. He's just an astonishing mind who knows more about football finance than most people do. But we're roughly the same age. We're from a similar background. He supports Brighton, I support Palace, yes. Which brings a different dynamic.
I was going to say though, yeah.
Yeah, which he didn't tell me until we'd done about pod number six. Cause, I'm childish enough. I wouldn't have done it if I'd known he was a Brighton fan beforehand. But it brings a certain dynamic. We're both very romantic about football to the point of naivety, I think. We both have an old-fashioned view about how important football is culturally and as a signifier of identity. How I think people just tapped into the fact they just want to learn what's being done, basically. And what happened was it coincided with the Berry story. And I think because we were articulating our anger about what was happening to Berry, and also because Kieran was explaining that it could be stopped at any time, and this is how it could be stopped, and people just were horrified by it, and it just sort of took off from there. We did our first live show 2 weeks ago at AFC Wimbledon, which went very well, sold out.
Great.
We're doing our next one at Accrington.
Where can people buy tickets for it?
Eventbrite, I think, or on Kieran's Twitter, and then we're going to be doing Peterborough, Plymouth, and various other places. These are not Hammersmith Apollo levels of size, but it's what we're really proud of as well, and you'll know this yourself. I think podcasts are brilliant. I may have mentioned this at the start. I think they're the most democratic thing that's happened to football and its fans for a long, long time. I think it's brilliant that finally fans are able to talk to other fans without having to phone in to Chris Sutton or Robbie Savage or try and get onto a, you know, try and wave at somebody outside a ground that's got a Sky camera. And I think they're brilliant. And also I do a 5-year plan, which is a Palace podcast that we do, which I love doing because, again, you know, if you do talk, I do Talk Sport a lot, Hawksby and Jacobs, because they're the only grown-ups on Talk Sport, so I do them a lot. But and it's great, you'll talk about football, but sometimes you'll find yourself, if you talk about Palace, you have to put it into context. So you'll mention a player, and then you have to explain who that is. But when you do the Palace one, you don't have to do that. It's just brilliant. It's like if somebody mentions Dave Swindlehurst, no one goes, who's Dave Swindlehurst? Everyone goes, oh, yeah, of course. Which, again, I love. And, again, every single club now has got 2 or 3 podcasts, and it's brilliant. And the clubs are having to acknowledge as well that the fans, clubs listen to podcasts. They really do listen to podcasts because that's the best way of them to find out what fans are really feeling. Not the people that are just tweeting every day. It's the best way to find out what fans are really thinking about. And I think it's great. I love doing them.
Yes, well, it's great. And it is great that there's loads of clubs have got their multiple podcasts. But if anyone else out there tries to do a football book club podcast, we'll get you.
We will track you down.
And democracy will be dead. You're welcome back on any time. We've loved having you on. We loved having you on. Jack, any last words?
Oh, God. hang on. Meat and 2 veg and turkey tell.
There we go. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Football Book Club. It featured James Bug, Jack Bernhardt, and Kevin Day. It was produced by friend of the show, James Bug. Thanks to Neil for writing the book, obviously, but where are they all now? Well, Neil has since retired from the game, written a second book, and if you want to see him with his top off, slip £500 to Kevin and he'll get you in touch with someone. Steve Sedgley has been banned from setting wake-up calls by all Hilton hotels worldwide. Alan Sugar went on to host The Apprentice, where he'd set tasks such as discreetly listen in on David Howell's voicemails. There is no evidence Charlie the Limp cannot sustain an erection, and there are simply too many members of the Fox Pub football team to catch up with. However, Satellite's Joe and Boyfriend, if you're listening, big love. The music Hills Behind is the work of Silent Partner and is used on a Creative Commons 4.0 basis. We'll be back in a fortnight. Until then, see you later!